My name's Brian Dwyer. This is The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. I'm delighted to have a number of guests tonight. One of our regulars, Deb Bradfield. How are you, Deb?
I'm very good, thanks, Brian, and good evening, everyone, or good afternoon.
And Tony Weber, who's been here before. And Tony's just off mic through no fault of his own. And making his debut on The Book Show, Dick Lithgow. How are you, Dick?
Good afternoon, Brian.
And it's great to have you in to Apollo Bay Radio. Now, as promised, Deb, we're going to talk about we're going to have to talk about John Banville tonight, amongst other things. But before we get there, let's see what you've been reading lately. Is that Cloud Atlas?
It is Cloud Atlas.
All 800 pages of it.
Was it 800? I know I'm struggling. No, it's actually only 520. Cloud Atlas, in fact, Tony spoke about this month ago maybe, and it sounded really interesting, so I grabbed it. But I am struggling with it. We keep swapping characters, and I just get sort of used to a character, and then they're gone, and then I'm starting on another one. But I have I'm continuing on with it, and I was thinking, at what point do you actually decide I'm not going to continue with this book?
That's,
you know,
a good,
I think
general, point that.
About 30, you know, 30, 40 pages in, I'll give it up. But when I've got this far, halfway, I feel like I've invested so much time in it that I should keep going.
I saw the film. I haven't read the book, and I won't read the book. And I thought the film was moderately interesting. Like, you know, good sci-fi always has ethical issues in it, and I found those interesting. I found the sort of Tom Hanks and his tribal people just a little bit cheesy, corny.
Yes, I think, well, that is one of the things that's putting me off a bit is the, I've come to one chapter, which is quite long, or a section called Slushes, Crossin' and Everything After. And this is the way it's written. It says, Ma didn't die, Sonmi's got mercy, see. My second time in the iconry was dreamin' night when 14 notches on our icons said we was a Grode Valleysman. We'd sleep lone in the iconry and Somni'd give us a spesh dreamin'. So I'm really struggling with, I'm not actually sure what
that left me quite cold.
Yeah, what that says. I mean, but Tony, gibberish. Because you enjoyed it so much, and I value your opinion, I'm continuing on, and because I think that it's going to really come together towards the end, and I'm going to think, well, maybe I should start it again now that I've got to the end of it. But I'll watch the movie because maybe that'll sort of fill it out for me more, and then I'll be better to come back to it. Perhaps.
Well, I was speaking to the librarian in Colac about it, and she treated it as a number of short stories, and she said she really enjoyed it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how she. I said, "How did you find this book?" And she said, "I really enjoyed it." So
okay,
there you go. And she hadn't seen the film,
yeah.
So
yeah,
anyway, you
a
know.
Series of short stories. Yeah, well, that might be a better way to approach
to
it.
Adapt,
but
yeah.
I think I've got a bit of an issue with writing that tries to give you a particular accent or a time in history, and so that you're getting that sound in your head when you're reading it because the words are written in such a way that it has that accent, and I think I find that a little bit annoying.
Well, it's a bit like Pidgin English. If you read books in Pidgin English, I think that's, you know, and that's how I, you know, cope with it. Like, you know, yeah, a bit of Pidgin English, but Pidgin whatever they're doing there.
Yes,
know?
Yes.
So
anyway, Tony, I'm going to continue, but
yeah,
it's because I've had about four books on the go. Yeah. I have to keep picking up and putting it down. But
right,
I'm sure the next time I see you, I will have finished it.
Right, good on you. Well done.
but as a science fiction book, it does raise some interesting ethical issues. So,
right,
you know,
yes,
if you're interested in, you know, the ethical issues of artificial intelligence and so on,
yep,
you might find it very interesting.
Yes. Well, I wasn't sure whether some of those people that are working for the others are actually just, you know, normal humans that have been raised differently, or whether they're, you know, whether they are.
But that's always one of the motifs of the robot book, isn't it? That nobody's sure who the robots are.
Do we find out at the end, Tony? Don't tell me then.
Now, give us the author and title again, Deb.
Yes, that was Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell.
Ah, yes, and I've made this point. This is not David Mitchell of BBC Light Entertainment fame.
Right. No, no, that's right. That David Mitchell, yes, he's quite funny, isn't he?
Yes.
But Lee read this and she enjoyed it too. So, you know, it's two people that I trust for giving recommendations. So,
well, I had an experience recently when Deb Ed gave me a book I'd never heard of, but because I trust Deb, I threw myself into it and it was wonderful. So I have implicit and total faith in Deb Ed's choice of books.
Yes. Also, though, the other thing is, and I'll bring this up when we talk about Banville, is you know, it could be a fabulous book, but you may not like it.
Yes.
So
yes,
it doesn't mean that it's a bad book. So it just depends on your taste.
Yes, that's right. It's like people.
Why aren't they all the same?
Now, I've started, Deb, I'm sure you'd like this, Murder in the Dark, a Phryne Fisher mystery.
Oh, I love Phryne Fisher.
I knew you would love Phryne Fisher.
Yeah, because of the clothes.
Yeah, by Kerry Greenwood. So it's set on New Year's Eve in 1928, I think.
Oh, fabulous. My favourite era.
Yes, when everyone was speculating on the stock exchange. But anyway, it looks like a lot of fun. I've only started. And I don't know, is it an advantage having seen the wonderful Essie
Davis.
Davis,
yeah,
as Phryne on the telly? I think it is.
Well,
I think it
picturing
is an advantage of having those images in your head when
yes,
you're reading it.
You're picturing her when,
Yes.
Yeah, she was wonderful in it. Not that I haven't read any of them, but I haven't even come across them actually. But yeah, I would like to read one of them.
She's written a stack, Kerry Green.
Yeah.
A stack. 39 novels. And that was, when was this published? Yeah, just can't find it, of course. 2006 she'd written 39 novels. So
right. So the Phryne Fisher series, that's a recent thing then. It's not an old, wasn't written a long time. I sort of assumed it was written years ago.
No, Kerry's, you see her quite often on book shows and things on TV and radio, yeah, she's
right.
She's our vintage. Murder in the Dark, a Phryne Fisher mystery by Kerry Greenwood. More about that in coming weeks. Now, Deb, that brings us to our special guest,
yes,
Dick Lithgow, and I love the cover of this book you've got, Dick. You better give us the title.
The title, Brian, Miss Gymkhana, R.G. Menzies and Me. The book is written by Kathy Skelton. It was published in 1990.
So it's a memoir.
It's a story of life in the 50s,
yes,
in downtown Sorrento.
And Kathy's about our vintage.
Yes, that will do.
Yes. Yep. Yes.
Kathy's no longer with us, unfortunately. And,
yes.
A very, very talented aspiring writer was taken from us with cancer 15 years or so ago, but this is a wonderful little tribute to her hometown, Sorrento, and beautifully written. And I came across it through my friendship with Kathy and her sister and her close friends, We attended a book launch in Sorrento last Sunday week. The book launch was put on by the Nepean Historical Society, which, right, in their studies of the 50s,
yeah,
decided, having come across this novel about life in the 50s, that they should contact the publishers and republish the book. And the launch of the book was attended by 120 Sorrento folk and friends of Kathy's from the Big Smoke, but they were mainly Sorrento locals, in the Hotel
That's
Sorrento.
That's a big launch.
Fantastic launch, yeah.
In the Hotel Sorrento.
Yes.
Therein lies the tale.
And the guest speaker who launched the book was Hanny Rayson, the author of the wonderful play Hotel Sorrento. Hanny was the next-door neighbour of Kathy and her sister Susie and a very close friend of theirs for many years.
Right.
Hanny told us a wonderful private tale of 1990 and what a wonderful year it was for her because she published the play Hotel Sorrento.
Right.
She used her next-door neighbour, Kathy, as a way of verifying that her play had the right amount of accuracy.
Yeah, critical friend.
Yes, a very good critical friend.
Yes.
Much to her surprise, at the end of 1990, Hanny, having published the play Hotel Sorrento, discovered that her very close friend and next-door neighbour, a very modest person, had just published her first book, which was Miss Gymkhana, R.G. Menzies and Me. So the book was being written whilst Kathy was being a critical friend to a playwright who published a very successful Australian play.
And she didn't breathe a word. Now,
not a
that
word.
Modesty or diffidence? I
think modesty in Kathy's. Her talents were such that she didn't need diffidence, but she was never one to sing her praises. Yeah. The book's wonderful. It's
And the connection with Menzies, is that just the fact that it's the 50s, or was there a connection with Menzies?
You need to read the book to
know. Oh, right, well, I might. I'll add it to the pile.
How can I sell a book if I give you that?
We're not going to find out much about it at all.
No, you are going to find out a little about it. No, there is clear reference to Sir Robert on a number of pages in the book in a number of ways. Kathy ties her her years growing up as a early teenage girl and through to the late teens by connecting local events of the time with her town and the people in her town, and then her own questions about growing up in a very, very special way.
Because it's always nice to read about something that you can relate to, same period of time for us growing up, you know, Menzies in power, which you know, and I know Sorrento well, so...
Well, you'd love it. If you know Sorrento well, you'd love it. Mm. You possibly might know some of the names in it too. I don't know whether she's protected herself by changing names or not, but she connects, for example... 2 days before Helen Wood, Miss Australia 1957, married Ashley Cooper, tennis champion. Lorna Larkham, Miss Gymkhana 1955, married Squeaker Sullivan, fullback and captain of the firsts. So she draws these beautiful connections, really beautiful connections, and she has a very witty way of talking about family, her family, the different politics, the different religions in her family, all information from the time that we would be familiar with. It's an easy read in the sense that it's beautifully written. The language is beautiful. It's much smaller than Cloud Atlas, which for someone like me who gets confused when he reads three or four books at once, I was able to finish it. And I believe, Brian, that would be a terrific book for school kids in year 8 or 9 to get a sense of history of the time, as well as reading some very good literature.
Yes.
Kathy was a wonderful English teacher who ended up working for the communications branch of the education department.
Right.
Her skillful writing just lends itself to having a good laugh, but also thinking about events. She draws in the Petrov affair. In our town, as Mrs. Petrov was escorted by KGB thugs Karpinski and Zarkov across the tarmac at Mascot Airport, Sess Burley, who drove our school bus and was the spitting image of Mr. Petrov, was on with Miss Pettigrew. And while Mr. Menzies, our Prime Minister, was trying to solve the Suez crisis, Auntie Ida was square dancing with strangers in the darkness outside the MCG while she waited for tickets to the grand final. So there's a lot of
ways. I love that. I love the way that kind of incongruous juxtaposition of different things. That's very, very amusing.
Mm.
It's quite a special. It's quite a special little read.
Yeah. Gymkhana. Yes. What's the Gymkhana?
Miss Gymkhana is the the local Sorrento Miss Showgirl.
Oh, yes.
The aspiration, of course, was to win Miss Gymkhana. Yes. But only one could, and I think from memory from reading the book that many of them were from out of town.
Oh.
So the local girls could aspire. But but it did appear that once you won Miss Gymkhana, you had success. You married the football captain or other such tales. You need to read it to find out.
Yeah. Gosh. Miss Gymkhana, R.G. Menzies, and Me by Kathy Skelton. Now, is there any chance, Dick, that book will be available in Apollo Bay?
Now, at the moment, it's available through the Nepean Historical Society or from the Antipodes Bookshop in Sorrento.
Right.
But I will be talking to Kathy on, not to Kathy, to Susie, her sister, on the weekend. And I'll duck into the local bookshop before I leave tomorrow to go to Melbourne to see if they're interested in having a small number of copies in the shop and put them in touch with the Nepean Historical Society.
Yes. I'm sure Lynn will be interested in that. I mean, well, I'm interested. I'd like to read that, I think.
I certainly want my three daughters to read it. So yeah. There's three Christmas presents here because not only will it let them know why their grandmother considered life the way she did, but it will give them a lot of appreciation about why their father is also so bizarre and has these weird ideas. So.
And there are a few photographs there, are there?
There are some lovely photographs. Each main chapter has got a double page of photographs in the middle. And here's one of Billy Graham at the MCG.
Billy Graham
gets a mention.
Yeah, so my grandmother went to see Billy Graham.
What year was that, do you think, Billy Graham?
59. My music bowl in 59.
I can remember the fuss about it.
Have a look at some other
And actually, I remember my grandmother spoke about catching a boat from Melbourne down to Sorrento. They used to do in the, I don't know when.
Oh.
Maybe in, I don't know, 1920 or something. I'm not quite sure when it was. Yeah, but there used to be a boat. Yeah, there used to be a lot more transport than what there is now, it seems to me sometimes. I think there used to be more trains.
Yes. Dick, just before we leave that, Kathy Skelton was a colleague and associate of yours in the education business.
She was a teacher in the western suburbs of Melbourne.
Yes. I think I met her one day at the Melbourne Cricket Ground. Would that be correct?
Distinctly possible.
I think that we were watching Test cricket, and I think you and Kathy were having a conversation about an article which she had published in the Age newspaper about the fact that although she was a feminist, she was quite keen on Timmy Watson and the Essendon Football Club, as my memory serves me correctly. I think that's right.
That's a family a family issue. I think Susie's the same. Yeah. Kathy wrote a wonderful article in The Age, which is possibly the inaugural article of female
football.
Real female interest in AFL football.
Wonderful. Wonderful. That's Kathy Skelton. Now, did you say she has another book, other books?
No, this is the only one that I'm aware of.
Is the one. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
Yes, taken too soon. Miss Gymkhana, R.G. Menzies, and Me by Kathy Skelton. As promised, Deb, we're talking about John Banville. Our regular listeners will remember we went into raptures about The Untouchable.
That's right, we did.
And It subsequently ended up on Lee Kelly's must-read list. Yes. She loved it too.
Well, I think she said it was the best book she'd... I don't know whether it was ever read or has I read this year. I can't remember. But it would, yeah, she was really impressed.
I think it's the best novel I've read.
Really?
Mm.
Gee. Yeah, I liked it, but it's I wouldn't very say good. That.
Yeah. Well, it's... the novel's The Untouchable, and it's the story of Anthony Blunt, the Cambridge spy who worked for a lifetime as in the British Public Service as the Queen's art curator and so on. So it's a novel about deceit, duplicity, treachery, and what motivates people. And very, very interesting, but the... What makes it a joy to read is that the character telling the story, the Anthony Blunt character, Victor Maskell, is himself a very knowledgeable, sophisticated, articulate and witty man, and he plays all kinds of games in the narrative, and it's such fun to read.
Yes. Possibly also full of self-loathing, you didn't actually add there, Brian. And I have been, because I just reread The Sea, and I have recently also read another of Banville's, this idea about this theme of self-loathing, it seems to be coming through quite a bit, so I'm not sure whether Banville is that happy with his with himself, really.
I mean, can you read that from the person's art?
Well, I was, and it is art. I'm glad you said art because I think Banville's novels are art more than just about anything else. But I did read him saying, yes, it is how he sees life. What he writes is how he sees life.
Ooh.
So, yeah, I know. It was a bit chilling.
Well, may I just give our listeners a little run through on The Sea. This novel won the 2005 Man Booker Prize. An aging man, Max somebody, recently widowed, returns to the boarding house which he knew as a child on seaside holidays. When he was 12 years old, his family was poor, but he befriended the children of the more affluent family who stayed in this house, the Cedars. So it's a novel about grief. He's recently widowed.
Mm.
Memory. Most of it is about him recalling the events of his 12th year, interspersed with what's happening to him as he comes back and stays in this odd old house. And it's about memory itself. One of the interesting things I found about this novel, Deb, is that the narrative voice says to you, well, it was late in the summer. Or, well, perhaps it wasn't late in the summer. Perhaps it was early in the summer.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
We tend to have this sort of presumption that the narrative voice is going to be fairly authoritative and reliable, and he just completely subverts that. And he's constantly saying, oh, I met this person, I can't remember their name.
Well, it's like you're in his head and you're just listening to his thoughts and his memories, which are, you know, not always quite spot on.
Yeah, so he's... It's written in the present tense, like, you know, I've just come back from my walk on the beach. And he's thinking to himself most of the time. He's trying to recall people and events from 50 years ago. He's constantly correcting himself. He's commenting that he's forgotten some details or that he can't find the word to express what he's thinking. I've never heard of a novelist saying that, you know. But it's all in Banville's polished prose, and it's all those powerful metaphors that he's always got. There's one which I'll read you in a minute about him following the landlady through the house. like the murderer in an Alfred Hitchcock film.
Yes. Yeah, you just get these wonderful pictures all the time. You know, you can just see it. Or, I think there was something about the mother's thighs through the gossamer of her dress. That I'm just paraphrasing this. But you could just see it. It was, just constant pictures being drawn for you.
And he, as a 12-year-old, he falls in love with the matronly lady next door. And he plays with the children, but he's in love with the matron. And at the age of 65, he concedes that she wasn't actually a very attractive person in any sense at all. So you get these sort of cringeworthy descriptions of her in her bathing suit.
Yes, that's right. But that also seems to be a recurring theme, because I read another one of his called Ancient Light, and that was all about him being in love as he was a 15-year-old boy, in fact having an affair with the mother of his best friend.
Oh,
so it is. Gosh. So I just wonder about his sexual exploits as a teenager, or whether it was just all fantasy, and did he fall in love with a lot of older women when he was when he was a teenager? I don't know, but it certainly does appear to be a recurring theme. The more I'm reading of Banville now,
oddness, if not to say deviance. Another interesting thing is that Max, like Victor Gaskell, is an art historian.
Yes, he is.
So Banville obviously likes to refer to works of visual art in his novels. And as if, you can somehow perhaps add some meaning to an experience by comparing it to a famous painting. Very interesting man.
Yes, extremely. Yeah, but and he apparently hates all his books. And I read an interview, but it was with a reporter from a French paper, and they said, "Is that true?" And he said, "Yes, I hate them. I mean that. Nobody believes me, but it's true. They're an embarrassment and a deep source of shame. They're better than everybody else's, of course, but not good enough for me." So he's got quite a good ego.
A personality flaw, perhaps. Some of the allusions to art and literature, did you notice that there are tips of the cap to Proust, the French, famous French,
yes, that's right. Yes,
to T.S. Eliot,
yes,
Prufrock and others.
Mm-hmm.
He, I think, to Thoreau, the American mystic.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't pick up, but apparently there are allusions to Thomas Becket's murder in.
I think
Cathedral.
I was reading that in this interview that I read with him, because he bit of a hero, I think.
Yes. But Max then feels that he's been a failure, both personally and professionally, and his reflections are in fact self-incriminating, whereas in the other book, The Untouchable, Maskell seems to be dodging responsibility all the time.
Yes, but I think again that self-loathing sort of comes through in both of them for me.
Yes. Now the much of the action of the book is about his experiences with the children of this affluent family, this Chloe, and the autistic child Miles.
They're twins.
Yes, and so you get a lot of this angst about how do you play with an autistic child, like it's very soulful stuff. And their nanny, the mysterious Rose, who might or might not be having an inappropriate relationship with the gentleman of the house.
Yes, that's right. That's what we're possibly led to believe at one point.
And surprise, surprise, when he comes back 50 years later or more, who should the landlady be but that very Rose herself?
Well, this was what – I've just read this for the second time. Mm. I read it because – and I'd pretty much forgotten the story completely because, of course, Banville is not big on plot, really. There is not a great deal of story at all in anything. It's all about the prose. And I got a lovely surprise when Rose turned out to be the landlady. I'd forgotten that completely, and it was a lovely little twist because all the way through, I mean, maybe they did say earlier, but if they did, I missed it. And it was I always love a little twist at the end.
Yes, and the section I was talking about. Deb, I would have said then that she was beautiful. Had there been anyone to whom I would have thought of saying such a thing, but I suppose she was not really. She was rather stocky and her hands were fat and reddish. There was a bump at the tip of her nose and the two lank strands of blonde hair that her fingers kept pushing back behind her ears and that kept falling forward again were darker than the rest of her hair and had the slightly greasy hue of oiled oak. She walked at a languorous slouch, the muscles in her haunches quivering under the light stuff of her summer dresses. She smelt of sweat and cold cream and faintly of cooking fat. Just another woman, in other words, and another mother at that. That, of course, is the sensibility of a 12-year-old.
And yes.
He doesn't spare you much, does he, Banville?
No, he does not.
He doesn't spare anybody much. And there's just something else I wanted to remind you of. And this is him as a 65-year-old man saying, I wonder if other people, when they were children, had this kind of image, at once vague and particular, of what they would like to be when they grow up. I'm not speaking of hopes and aspirations, vague ambitions, that kind of thing. From the outset, I was very precise and definite in my expectations. I did not want to be an engine driver or a famous explorer. When I peered wishfully through the mists from the all too real, then to the blissfully imagined now, this is, as I've said, exactly how I would have foreseen my future self, a man of leisurely interests and scant ambition, sitting in a room just like this one, in my sea captain's chair, leaning at my little table in just this season, the year declining towards its end in clement weather, the leaves scampering, the brightness imperceptibly fading from the days, and the street lamps coming on only a fraction earlier each evening.
Yeah. See, I love it, but it is polarizing, I realise now. I just thought, oh, you know, everyone would love it, but they don't. I was reading a New York reviewer, and he said, of the sea, this stilted, claustrophobic and numbingly pretentious tale about an aging widower revisiting his past. And actually, I've read a few reviews like that, mainly from Americans, it seems. But I suppose you could see it like that. But to me, I just get swept along by that prose all the time. It just encompasses me, and I flow with it. I don't care if nothing happens.
Yeah,
it's just
a pleasure to read that prose. That is beautiful.
Yeah, it is. Apparently, rhythm is his main thing. That's what he's particularly interested in. Even before vocabulary, it's rhythm.
I bet he goes for walks on the beach.
Well, I'm sure he does.
A lot of great writers do.
But he spends hours and hours on one sentence. Yeah. And he actually, he writes under a pseudonym as well, called, that's someone black, and he writes crime novels. And
Oh, really? Yes.
And he just churns out, writing under black, he churns out 2,500 words a day as black. But he said when he reverts back to Banville, he can spend 6 hours straight on one sentence, and he says not a particularly good one at that. So he goes back, he'll write a sentence, and he'll go, he'll know it's not perfect, and there might be one word wrong, and he just hasn't got the right word. And so he goes off, and he might come back to it a week later and think, yeah, I've got the word now, and that's what's going in there. And they are, the sentences are just a delight.
They are.
They are beautiful to read.
And I dare say they're a bit like a Rubik's Cube. Because if there's one thing out of place, the whole thing's wrong.
Yes. That's
so
right.
So you have to start from scratch every time.
Yes. So apparently, like this one's not that long. My copy is only 263 pages. I just read in a couple of days, this second reading. And that could take him 10 years to write that, which is extraordinary.
And in the meantime, to pay the rent, he knocks out a few crime novels.
Yes, this Black, what was the name? It also began, Benjamin Black. So that's his pseudonym. And he says he does it occasionally when he thinks, I don't want to have to write another Banville novel right now, so I'll become Benjamin Black.
I'm sure it's exhausting.
Mm.
Just before we go on this issue, Deb, The Sea, it's called The Sea. It's not like a Tim Winton novel, which is actually about the sea, as Breath is.
Yes.
Is it Breath or Breathless?
Breath, Tim Winton Breath. Yeah.
It's called The Sea. Well, spoiler alert, there is a death at sea, so that has an impact on him. He spends this luxurious time as a child at the seaside when his marriage has failed and his wife has died, and he's grieving both of those things, and his daughter's not speaking to him. He goes for solace to the seaside. So I'm kind of getting a sense of why he called it The Sea.
Yes, and I think the very last line.
Oh, read us the last line.
Maybe. I may be wrong here, but
and while you're finding it, perhaps the sea is like life itself.
Oh, here we go.
Overwhelming. Dreadful.
Yeah, it says, a nurse. Oh, this is his wife has just died. He's outside because he actually missed the death. And a nurse came out then to fetch me, and I turned and followed her inside, and it was as if I were walking into the sea.
The Sea by John Banville. This is The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. I'm with Tony Webber and Dick Lithgow. Deb has gone home for her dinner. And
to watch the Cloud Atlas.
And to watch the movie, Cloud Atlas. Yes.
And did you watch the bit after, how they produced it?
No, I didn't.
That was fascinating, Nat. I think you missed. I'm really encouraging Deb to do that. Yeah.
I kind of ran out of time because it's quite a long film.
It
anyway.
Is, yeah.
Yes. You have mentioned this book before, Tony.
I have.
Something to do with World War One.
It is. It's called The Bridge Over the River. There's no author. It's anonymous. But the author is, and I don't know if you could call it non-fiction, you could call it fiction. It depends on your outlook. You know? So this young fellow, a German soldier, is killed on the Western Front. He's not killed immediately. He's shot through the lungs. Sorry, not on the Western Front, on the Russian Front. And he takes about 2 weeks to die.
Right.
And as the book goes on, this is a blessing to take time to die, because then you can adjust. he says, and this is this book is basically a report from heaven. That's what it claims.
Oh, yes.
So this young fellow says, if you're killed instantly, it's such a tearing from your physical form that it's really hard. Yeah. So he's appreciated the fact that it's taken him 2 days to die once he has died. So anyway, so then his sister starts, in the daytime, fully conscious, starts receiving things from him.
Right.
So, and she's writing them down day by day, her receiving of these messages that come to her head, and she feels that there's a presence around her. So this young fellow is apparently, according to this book, when you die, it takes a while for you to actually transition from your physical form into your spiritual form.
Right.
So you're sort of held to the earth while you're in this process, and it takes about, you know, between 6 months and 12 months to actually transition away from your physical form.
It's interesting, because the Buddhists have believe that it takes a certain time, don't they, like days?
It varies with each person, but what holds you is the grief of the people that have loved you.
And that holds you?
It holds you to your physical form. So then he tries to tell her to stop this terrible grieving because they've been so close. You know, he's got a number of sisters and brothers, but this particular sister is really close to him.
Right.
So he tries to communicate to her to grieve, but not to continue this grieving because it's slowing his progression away from his physical form. And so she keeps getting these daily messages. So it's written in the form of a day-by-day account. And this is in 1915 into 1916 while the war's going on. So she's, you know, the whole family's grieving at the loss of this young fellow.
Yes.
Now, he's been a potentially a great composer, this young fellow. And there was two other composers, apparently, or potential composers that were killed in the First World War. One was an Australian, Frederick Septimus Kelly. I don't know if either of you have heard of him.
No.
So he was writing some really interesting music, and he was taken early in the First World War. Right. And then there was a Frenchman who was badly injured and never really achieved what he could have. You know. So these are the three people, apparently, that would have been maybe quite famous composers if they'd survived the First World War.
There were others.
Yeah, that's right. But these are the three that people have picked out. Yeah. Yes. So this fellow's, you know, composing all this music right at the beginning and into the wartime while he's waiting to get onto the Russian front. So he's, you know, and that's sort of a part of this report back, because then he's describing what heaven is like. And the music in heaven is so important, you know, and because he's a musician, he's highly regarded. He's got people guiding him sort of through heaven. And it is quite an amazing description of, you know. And heaven, according to him, is a vast expanse, you know, much greater than anything that he's ever seen, It's affected by the sun, which is quite interesting. And he's got all these guides. And people wander off, and there's conflict in heaven, according to him, quite a lot. And the conflict only occurs in darkness. And it's because of people are wandering away and they're trying to be drawn back. So it seems this great tug of war going on.
Oh,
And of course, the ultimate is to get to the light and then to travel further into heaven. So, it's quite fascinating. And the people have reviewed it, like writer Rudolf Steiner reviewed it. Reviewed all her writings.
It's quite old then.
It is. Well, this book's completed in 1950.
Yes.
So this woman has contemplated whether she should actually write all this down into a book form, and then she's given it to Rudolf Steiner to read, and he's nodded in agreement. He's quite convinced that this is what's happened, you know. It's not just some sort of imagination.
So as you're reading it, whose voice are you hearing? The woman's voice? Is it?
Well, she's reporting what she's getting from her brother, writing it down. And he's with her while she's writing this down, trying to relieve her grief.
Yes.
You know? And so then he can get away. Otherwise, he's tied to her and her grief.
Right.
So he's trying to convince her that, you know, he'll be all right. And so this is part of a convincing of her. So, yeah, it's quite a, well, as someone said, it's a unique book. It was reviewed on the Rhythm Divine a couple of weeks ago, which is a radio program on Radio National at 5:30 on a Sunday morning. Right. Fascinating program on all sorts of music related to religion and yoga and whatever. So it's The Bridge Over the River with no author. Well, the author is the sister who's just referred to as M.
Anonymous, The Bridge Over the River. Where did you get it from, Tony?
They've got copies in the cow shop in Colac, Cowlick Bookshop in Colac. When I ordered it, they read the review and said, oh, we'll get a few copies of that.
And were you interested because of the musical...
Well, I was just interested in this fellow's reviewing of it, you know. And then he played some of the music of Kelly, the Australian composer, before he was killed. So, it was quite an it was a program about potential composers killed in the First World War before they really had a chance.
The Lost Generation.
Yeah, it was. It was horrible, really, wasn't it? You know. So anyway, I may actually, if people are interested, may read a sort of, when I'm here in the radio studio, read a day-by-day account of as they slowly start establishing contact with one another.
Would you like to read some now?
Well, if you want
I'll give you, I'll give you 30 seconds to find something, Tony.
Rightio. So this is part of this. This is from August 9, 1915. The sun plays a great part here too. It provides the strength for all spiritual striving, just as it also gave me the power for my work on earth. Its influence is tremendous, here and on the physical plane as well. It penetrates the physical much deeper than one imagines. One does not see the sun sometimes, but its effect is nevertheless accompanying in many planets, each existing in its own influence. This is all so unspeakably deep and great that one's amazement never ceases. I regret I have not developed further for perceiving it more clearly. The human brain can simply not comprehend the fullness of all that it surrounds us and the earth. My will is to become great every day, and daily I am gaining more. A time has begun for all of you to see things in a different light. This is the first step. This is behind you. It will proceed faster than I dared hope. Everything you will need for further advancement will now be given to you naturally. And so that's just the effect of the sun, according to this, in heaven. So, and for us as well. So it's sort of like moving into another dimension, I'd imagine.
For mystics.
Well, probably. And maybe even for theoretical physicists, as we were discussing with Lisa Randall, who's in Australia at the moment and is discussing the distortions in the fifth dimension.
Remind me, which one's the fifth dimension?
Well, it's beyond time. You know, you've got the three physical dimensions and you've got time, which is the fourth dimension, and then you're moving into... Right. So this is string theory, where there are 11 dimensions in string theory. Lisa Randall... She gave that lecture on Thursday night. If I was able to get to Melbourne, I definitely would have gone to it. So,
and you've just reminded me, Tony, that at this time next week, the Science Book Show will be on. We'll have Liz Cameron, hopefully Deb Bradfield, and maybe others talking about the whole world of science. Dick Lithgow might come in and talk to us about science and perhaps mathematics.
The probability of picking a winner, Brian.
Probability. Before we go, Tony, I can tell you that next week or maybe the week after, I'll be talking about Sumner Locke Elliott's Water Under the Bridge,
right,
which is quite a witty title because it's about a number of people in Sydney, and the story opens on the night of the opening of the Sydney Harbour Bridge in 1932. And there are fireworks and there are parties all around the harbour. And the people at one particular party remain loosely connected for the next 40 years. There's a murder. There are premature deaths. There are unhappy marriages, disappointed lovers. There are issues of class, wealth, status, power, the depression, the war. I found it quite a ripping yarn, actually, and quite an interesting observation of Australian society, admittedly, you know, mainly before my time, but quite interesting. So more about that on a future edition of the book show. That's Sumner Locke Elliott's Water Under the Bridge, first published 1977. He was the man who wrote Careful, He Might Hear You, which Paul Cox, I believe, made into a, was it Paul Cox? Made into a successful film, starring Wendy Hughes and John Hargreaves. Yes. Sumner Locke Elliott. And another one I would like to talk at some length about, and we don't have time tonight, and that's Thomas Hardy's The Mayor of Casterbridge. This is, every now and again, you go back and read one of the so-called classics, you know, the canon of, you know, the venerated literature, and you do realise why they're popular. I mean, it's very, very good. It's very good.
Well, they've made TV series on it, haven't they?
Yes.
You know, so it has. It's been...
Hardy, I think, because he's so visual, he lends himself to TV adaptations. And his stories are, well, they're tragedies, really. You know, they're tragedies. This is the story of a young farm labourer who, through hard work and giving up the grog and, you know, strength of character, becomes a wealthy man. And then, because of some bad luck and some bad errors of judgment, he falls into ruin. It's quite a sad story, but it's got a whole cast of interesting characters. And it's set in the fictional Wessex, which is around Dorchester, Salisbury in the southwest of England.
That was the basis of the sort of pre William the Conqueror.
Yes, the Kingdom of Wessex with Alfred and Ethelred and Harold and all of those. So Hardy adopted it as a name. And the interesting thing is, since Hardy has adopted it as a name, and he's writing in the 1880s, a number of commercial interests have adopted it as a promotional thing. So all throughout England, the name Wessex appears as if it's a real place. It ain't a real place.
Well, it's been revived, basically, hasn't it, I suppose, in a way?
Well, it's in people's imagination. There is, I'm sure there's no county of Wessex.
Oh, no,
it's
there isn't. But, I mean, there would have been at one time, wouldn't there? There was the basis of the... Well, what were they called in those days before the Normans?
Oh, yes, that's a good point. But, well, that's right. I mean, he's... It was the realm of the pre-Norman medieval Anglo-Saxon kings, but Hardy invented it as a 19th century place.
But in our many dimensional world, place may be in our mind.
that's right. And it's hard to tell the fictional from the factual these days. But anyway, I do recommend Thomas Hardy as well. So, lots more coming up on the book show. We're talking about science books next week, and on the 6th of December, Deb and Kathy will and Lee Kelly will be reviewing cookbooks.
Oh, right.
Not to be missed. Mm. The 6th of December, the cookbook show.
Free Christmas cookbooks.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you, Tony Webber.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Dick Lithgow. It's been great to have you on Apollo Bay Radio. And do come back. This is Apollo Bay Radio.